Like a lot of you, I read the Bible regularly. Sometimes that book can be a lot to take in. And I've asked myself more than once, what did I just read? I'm sure you have too. I'm Jessica Botiford. Welcome to the Bible Rewind. In April 2022, I attended an event hosted at the University of Florida about Christianity and environmentalism. I had not been outside in months because of COVID, and it was great meeting new people. At the time, I was working on the Noah's Ark episode featuring Brother Henri Ward.
Noah is a person in the Bible who is meant to tell a story about God's relationship with humanity. It was never created for scientific proof that the world was flooded and the two by twos.
Everything that needed to be said about Noah's Ark was captured in this interview. At least that's what I thought, until I met Brady McCartney at the Christianity and Environmentalism event.
My name is Brady McCartney, and I'm an interdisciplinary environmental studies scholar at the University of Florida.
Editing Jessica here. At the time of this interview, Brady worked at the University of Florida. Currently, he is the director of the Eco League Environmental Education Consortium. Okay, back to the show.
I study environmental issues from a bunch of different perspectives, including religious studies, history, environmental science. So trying to sort of study issues and all their complexity from a lot of different angles to have a more well-rounded perspective.
And Brady said Noah's Ark could also be seen as a climate change story.
Any story, any text can be interpreted a variety of ways, including the story of Noah's Ark. Central to that story is sort of a relationship between Noah and his God, and this idea that a flood of, I think it's not like too much of a pun to say, of biblical proportions, right, would be impacting Noah, but also all of the animals and ecosystems around him. The dictate to Noah was not simply to save himself or to just save his family, but to save like as much of the biodiversity around him as he could, because all of those creatures were God's creatures, right? Were created by God. So that's part of the reason why I think the Noah's Ark story is a bit of a climate change story. And, you know, climate change is always unfolding. I think what's new about this era is that it's really human-induced climate change. If you look at the post-industrial revolution period, we see significant changes that just had not been seen prior to humans unlocking some of our potential through various technologies. But there is a definite break between sort of the climate changes we would see pre-industrial revolution and those we see post.
I have to tell you that my mind was actually blown when you said Noah's Ark is a climate change story. Because first of all, it's always wonderful when the Bible can be applied to contemporary issues. Once you said it, I said, exactly, especially because the reason why the flood came, it was a punishment, if you will, for human sin. And it could be they were just abusing the earth the way a lot of people feel we're doing right now. And then God asked Noah to respond to that by creating a safe space for himself, his family, and all the earth's creatures.
There is a sense that humans, through the flood, are atoning for their sin, for their acts. But there's also a sense that God wants humans and all creatures to survive despite this punishment.
We must focus on stopping global warming, or the polar caps are going to melt and we're all going to drown. And I just want to say, have you ever seen a rainbow? Because every time there appears a rainbow, this is the promise of God that he will never again destroy the earth by water. Relax. Now, maybe you'd rather drown than burn. I don't know. So maybe you prefer.
That's Reformed Baptist pastor John MacArthur from his sermon about global warming and environmentalism. MacArthur goes on to say that it's a biblical truth that we can use the planet and extract everything out of it.
Responsible kind of stewardship, as man has already demonstrated.
He calls this stewardship, but is it or is that dominion? Both words can be found in the Bible depending on the translation. The King James Version says,
"And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth." Genesis 1 verse 26.
So dominion, I think, implies that humans are allowed to use the natural world in whatever way they see fit and can use the resources within the natural world and deplete them to zero. The scholars I've read really suggest that the more appropriate translation is steward or stewardship, not dominion. There's not this sense that humans have full reign over other living creatures, over other animals. Stewardship implies this relationship of care, this relationship of a gardener in God's kingdom, in God's garden. Because these are God's creatures, this is God's kingdom, that humans are meant to support other living beings and allow them to flourish. Genesis chapter 1, verse 30, you see this quotation.
"And to all the beasts of the earth, and all the birds in the sky, and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food. And it was so."
This idea of being fruitful and multiplying, I think right there in Genesis, right at the top, you have a sense that this world was created again for the flourishing of non-human animals. There's literally food for them is embedded into this world, embedded into this kingdom, or embedded into this ecosystem, depending on how you care to look at it.
And even just talking about Genesis, I think about in the beginning when God created, although the last day that he created, he made humans, but he also made the entirety of the ecosystem. And that is all part of the perfection. It's not just humans by themselves.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think the order tells you something, right? The order of creation. If humans come at the end, I think there is certainly a sense that God placed at least equal priority on other parts of his kingdom. Sometimes the flood gets connected to end of the world scenarios. But if you read the Bible pretty closely, and obviously, again, lots of interpretations, but you see a desire for humans and all living creatures created by God to continue on after the flood. This is not a final sort of judgment on any level.
That is so interesting that you brought that up, because I am thinking about the end of times. I know some people are resistant to the idea of climate change because they believe, well, this is just a sign that Jesus is coming back. The Guardian made a documentary called The Climate and the Cross. In it, a pastor from Florida shared his point of view.
The Bible talks about the end times. There's going to be wars, there's going to be famines, there's going to be droughts, there's going to be floods, there's going to be all these things that happen. And I don't believe that global warming causes this. This is just the Bible fulfilling itself, and these things are going to happen. And as they continue to happen and they continue to get worse, there's nothing we can do to stop it.
You will hear of wars and rumors of wars, but see to it that you are not alarmed. Such things must happen, but the end is still to come. Nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines and earthquakes in various places. Matthew 24, verses 6 and 7.
The idea that we can just set aside God's creation, God's kingdom, and write it off and say that, okay, because these are end times, that it is not our duty to continue to care for God's creations. I don't think that actually squares with the Bible. There are a lot of Christians who don't believe that end times means that means environmental disaster, environmental ruin at the hands of humans is sanctioned or even allowed just because you're not paying attention. Some of my research has focused on traditions who do focus on sort of the idea that we're in end times, that the second coming of Jesus is near. I don't really know how to convince folks who are that convinced that we are in end times. I think there have been a number of dates that were supposed to sort of mark the end times that we've passed and passed again and again.
And again.
And again.
But about that day or hour, no one knows, not even the angels in the heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. Matthew 24, verse 36.
From the end times people, what have you observed?
There are some who use end times to justify sort of lack of care for the environment or write off climate change as something they don't have to really think about or is actually part of this end times narrative. So they're preparing spiritually, but sort of in the material world, it's really not of great consequence because they presume that they are, you know, they'll be identified by Jesus as part of the elect and they will ascend to heaven or to whatever is next.
Right. And everything on this earth will pass away. So why should they have to worry?
Yes. Which is convenient, right? Because if you think that way, then it doesn't matter that, right, that the that our levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere continue to grow.
Every year, more and more oil and coal are burnt to meet the demands of energy across the globe. This has caused the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to go up. As carbon dioxide increases, so does the acidification of oceans, which is connected to the growing intensity of storms in coastal communities. For example, in 2018, Hurricane Michael ripped through Mexico Beach, Florida, and homes were demolished. While Florida is no stranger to hurricanes, this storm hit differently.
The hurricane made landfall, took direct aim at Mexico Beach where Ginger was. And, you know, we had an anxious moment during our special report when we actually lost contact with Ginger at the height of the storm. Thank goodness she had hunkered down out of harm's way, but she also saw something never seen in all her years covering monster storms, a home washed away right in front of her eyes.
My heart is racing. I have never seen something like an entire home, a well-built home, rolling down the street. We just watched that happen in real time. And I'll tell you right now, it makes you shake.
Not thinking about sort of environmental issues or changes in the climate, it's also connected to deep suffering of your fellow humans and potentially other Christians, if you care about them. Like, they may lose their home, they may lose their lives, they may lose a family member. And that, I think, is important if you are a Christian.
A year before Hurricane Michael hit Florida, The New Yorker published an article called Doomsday Prep for the Super Rich. And I quote, "In private Facebook groups, wealthy survivalists swap tips on gas masks, bunkers, and locations safe from the effects of climate change."
There's a certain amount of wealth that is seen as allowing people to sort of absorb the worst of climate change by going and literally purchasing the land that is seen as most climate resilient. But I don't think anybody gets out of this one. Your time will come. It might look different than you're expecting. But again, we've already seen impacts of climate change. Like, it's already impacting your world, whether you recognize it or not, whether you're like really feeling it at this moment or not. But I think we will all have our Hurricane Katrina at some point. And I care about people and I care about the environment. And I want us to all live the lives we were meant to live. But acknowledging that there are some constraints that maybe didn't exist before human-induced climate change.
Climate change is a threat to everyone, but people from marginalized groups are more vulnerable. And this is where the environmental justice movement comes in.
So the environmental justice movement was really trying to put a focus on human beings in this larger conversation, but also think about who has access to these environmental goods. And who, as a byproduct, may be experiencing environmental degradation or devastation, because there's often an element of moving one community's environmental issue to another's. You got issues with toxic waste in your community? Let's find another community that has maybe less wealth, less political power, and maybe black or brown, and let's move like a toxic waste facility into that community. And we can argue that it has to go somewhere and that toxic waste, like dealing with it is a good thing. But if it's such a good thing, why don't you just keep it in the community that created it or near the corporation that created it? So we see a redistribution of environmental waste toxics from generally wealthier and generally whiter communities to economically impoverished Black and Brown communities, at least in this country.
There is an 85-mile stretch of land between New Orleans and Baton Rouge near the Mississippi River, nicknamed Cancer Alley. This place has also been called Plantation Country, as a reminder of the enslaved Black people who were forced to work there. I can't even decide which moniker is worse, Cancer Alley or Plantation Country. They both suck. Over 100 factories have been pumping toxins into the air in Cancer Alley, where most of the people, no shock, are African American. Cancer Alley residents are at a much higher risk of dying from cancer or having stillborn births.
If all of these people are not part of your beloved community, then maybe you got to, one, go back to the Bible and really think deeply about what you've been reading, your interpretations. But two, if you're not caring for all Christians who come in every shape and size, every race, every ethnicity you can imagine, then are you being the Christian that, at the very least, I think Jesus would want you to be based on what we know about his life and his beliefs?
Right. Are you loving your neighbor?
Right. And you don't get to choose your neighbors, I have found. Right? Unless you are so wealthy, you can buy up the block and you don't have any neighbors. And that ain't me. And I don't think that's you, Jessica.
That's definitely not me.
The environmental justice movement is linked to the fight for civil rights and human rights. Dr. Robert Bullard, who many would call the founder of the environmental justice movement, researched how toxic producing structures are often placed in marginalized communities. After his wife, Linda McKeever, pointed him in the right direction, Dr. Bullard documented how almost all of Houston's landfills and incinerators were located in Black neighborhoods in the late 1970s.
You know, my wife came home one day and said, Bob, I've just sued the state of Texas, and I've sued this company that's trying to put this landfill in the middle of this suburban, middle-class Black community in Houston. And she said, I needed somebody to collect data for this lawsuit and put the where the pins are and where the landfills are on a map. And I said, well, you need a sociologist. She said, that's what you are, right? That's how I got roped into this. I got drafted.
I would point out that the Black church was also essential to the creation of the environmental justice movement. You see, obviously, the Black church playing a huge and leading and ongoing role in the civil rights movement. But you also see in the early stages of the environmental justice movement, even 10 years on, the United Church of Christ as one of the churches that really showed leadership, certainly at that time and continues to. They worked with Robert Bullard to create some of the key reports that actually like scientifically documented how toxic waste was being, you know, dumped in, again, largely Black and Brown and economically impoverished communities. So just want to highlight the role of the Black church. So if we're thinking about another movement that we, one, should be pleased that exists in our country, but also has like deep connections to the Black community, that's another one that maybe you didn't learn about in your history classes or throughout your education that is critical.
Sure didn't. Sure didn't. What can we do honestly? What big impact can I as an individual have?
So one way we can really push back against environmental injustice is by recognizing that a lot of environmental injustice and environmental racism really does happen on the local level. I have found local leaders, county leaders, even state leaders to be far more accessible and responsive. And not that you always have sort of a political solution to these issues, but often agencies, political leaders are signing off on some of these projects, and they're really not hearing from constituents who will be impacted by these decisions. But individual citizens, I think really at the local, county, state level, like your voice can be heard in a way that at the federal level, right now, it just does not feel possible. But, you know, there's some decisions made at the local level where like a mayor has a lot of sway. Their Department of Environmental Protection has a lot of sway. You don't need sort of the resources you need to build like a big federal level campaign. As consumers, we certainly play a role. If you have any retirement accounts, you have investments that might be investing in companies that are engaged in environmental injustice, and shareholders often have a voice in corporations that is underappreciated and can push, for example, a board of directors. The University of Florida, right? We have a faculty, we have graduate students who all have access to a retirement system. There's a lot of power through retirement and pension plans where, like, if you don't want your collective efforts to fund certain kinds of projects, you do have a voice. You might not win every battle. I think it's safe that you won't win most battles. But if you win some, like any movement, you just don't know how things will unfold and what kind of success starts to snowball.
You're more optimistic than me, I have to say.
Yeah, I think it depends on what day you catch me, whether somebody believes that I am optimistic or not. You know, if you look at, again, the end of Dr. King's life, he's really being pushed to think about environmental justice issues. You know, one of the organizations was the National Welfare Rights Organization, which was largely run by African-American women at that time, and often economically impoverished women who were just organizing.
The National Welfare Rights Organization advocated for adequate income, dignified treatment, justice, and democratic participation for welfare recipients in the 1960s and 70s. This organization's work echoed some of the objectives of the environmental justice movement.
They had hope. They had the energy, despite all that they were dealing with. And if they can maintain hope, I have no reason to live in despair.
There is no Bible verse that explicitly says, protect and save the environment or you will face certain doom. But Jesus did say,
truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. Matthew 25, verse 40.
Jesus's core message, right? Like if you had to sum it up, at least the scholarship I read, like love thy neighbor sort of wins out, / care for the poor. Justice and environmental justice are focused on people who are, one, your neighbors, whether you recognize that or not, and two, people who might not have the resources to sort of fight back. So we can call them economically poor, we can call them sort of politically poor, but like they are people who might not be as advantaged as you. But you, as a Christian, I think the Bible very clearly and Jesus very clearly says, love thy neighbor, care for those in your community.
Amen to that. I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Bible Rewind, and I invite you to visit BibleRewind.com for the show transcript, the list of resources we used to make today's show, and the recommendations from our guests. This podcast is intended to serve as a starting point, but I highly encourage you to read the Bible and explore all of its epic stories for yourself. And a big thanks to Gaia LaBelle for finding music for this episode.